Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Cyber threats against governments and against private companies have increased in both volume and complexity. In fact, Vice President Pence recently referred to such threats from China. In this week's episode of World Affairs, we'll discuss how to prevent, prepare for, and respond to the danger of cyber attack. Joining us is John Carlin. He's one of the country's foremost experts in cybersecurity. He's the former Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's National Security Division. He's also the author of a new book entitled Dawn of the Code War: America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. You engaged in a number of high-profile cases, ranging from the Boston Marathon bombing to the attack on Sony to Iranian attacks on the financial sector. And you know, they all have different motivations and different actors. But you've argued that there's such a thing as a blended threat, when maybe theft moves into terrorism, moves into something else. So say something about that, what that blended threat looks like.
So imagine that you're at a company and you're the CEO, and you find out, you get a knock on the door, and someone on your information technology side says, "Boss, I got a problem. Someone has hacked inside of our system and they've stolen a small amount of personally identifiable information, some names and addresses."
So it looks like a modest danger.
Looks like a low risk. They say, "We know how they got in. We made a mistake. This doesn't look sophisticated." Happens every day to millions of individuals across the world and thousands of companies. So most companies say, okay, and they go on about their business, right? So then imagine, though, a couple weeks later, they come back and say, "Hey, boss, we got an email." And on this email, it's written, it's not the best grammar or spelling, but they say two things. One, they're mad that we threw them off the system, so they want us to let them back into our system. And number two, they said, "Well, we got this information. We want to embarrass your company unless you give us $500 through Bitcoin." So again, this is just life in business now.
Where most businesses would just pay. It's part of the cost of doing business.
That's right. And it's hard to tell exactly how many, but estimates are that this has happened to something like 40% of businesses, and that the majority are just paying yeah. The bad guys off.
Yep.
So in this case, they were feeling pretty good, because if he was a really good hacker, he wouldn't have to ask their permission to be let back onto the system. And it's a relatively low dollar amount. Most companies at that point handle it on their own. They don't talk to anyone in government, and they think of it as just a low-level criminal event. In this case, which is a real case, they did work with government. And what they found out is who's on the other end of that hack. And that's what makes cyber different than other types of crime. You really don't know who it could be.
Yeah.
And what they found out here was that it was an extremist from Kosovo who moved from Kosovo to Malaysia. And from Malaysia, a place that had better broadband in part, so it made it easier for him to hack. From Malaysia, he was working with a fellow co-conspirator in Kosovo. They hacked into this trusted company inside the United States, took information that customers gave, hoping the company would protect it, to this company.
Sort of name and address and that kind of thing?
Yes.
Or well beyond?
Not well beyond, but that type of information, the same type of information consumers are giving every day to companies, right? And what Farizi, and that was his name, was doing with this information was, he did want to make $500, but he also had made contact with someone who was quite familiar to us at the National Security Division at the time. He's a British citizen, who's living in the London area in the United Kingdom. And he was a former computer hacker. He gets out of jail, and he ends up being radicalized and moving from England to Raqqa, Syria, where he's located at the very heart of ISIS. And he's spending his days at trying to convert people to kill. He does not meet Farizi in the real world. He meets Farizi through Twitter. and develops a relationship with him. And he convinces Farizi to give the information that's entrusted to this U.S. company that Farizi has stolen, to give him that information. And Junaid Hussein could care less about making a buck. He wants to do what ISIS does. And at this point, their strategy is they kill. They were killing with impunity, Muslims, non-Muslims alike. They were using slavery as part of their tool of political dominance. And they were using rape as an intimidation tactic. That's who Junaid Hussein was. So what he does with this information stolen from this company where customers have entrusted it is he creates an actual kill list. So he calls through it to see, oh, who here looks like they might be a local police officer or government worker. He gets those names and addresses. And then again, using Twitter, he pushes that information out to the United States and says, kill these people by name, by address, where they live. That's the blended threat. What starts out looking like a small criminal act ends up in the hands of a terrorist and going from the world of bits and bytes and cyber problems to real world consequences that could be life or death.
And how did you disrupt this kind of operation? I mean, it's clear that from this story, this event, the Department of Justice and other parts of government learned a lot about how ISIS works, right, and other terror groups. How did you disrupt something like this, though? How did you catch them?
And that's what's key to this new world in which we're living. We wouldn't be able to disrupt a case like this without working with the private company who knows what was taken and how it was taken. In this case, working together, we were able, and that's one of the reasons I can go into so many of the details with you today and with your listeners, we were able to bring criminal charges against Farizi where he resided in Malaysia, and then through the State Department work with the Malaysians in order to obtain Farizi and bring him back to the United States. So he has now pled guilty after being brought to the United States. He's pled guilty in Virginia and was sentenced to around 20 years in prison. Junaid Hussein presented a different problem. He was located, again, in Raqqa, Syria, which essentially was a war zone outside the reach of law enforcement, and he was killed in a military strike that was publicly acknowledged by Central Command. But if you think about what was involved with this case, we have countries from the U.S. to Kosovo to Malaysia to England to Syria, all of which were had to be involved. You have cyber, where things are moving incredibly quickly, and you have real-world terrorism. You had to use different arms of power in order to address the problem, from diplomacy to military force to law enforcement, and working together with allies from Malaysia to England across the world. When you think about all the reforms we made post 9/11, I think this highlights where we still need to go, which is, as good as we got at sharing information within and between governments, that's not enough. For this threat, you have to figure out a way, how do we share information to the private sector at scale and speed about what this threat is? And how do we figure out ways to receive that information back while respecting our core values about privacy and civil liberties?
Now, what are their concerns? I mean, I think about a company, frankly, worried about letting others know because it frightens their customers and it frightens their shareholders. Is there a relationship of trust, a sort of sense that, no, I can talk to the government, I can talk to the Justice Department without this getting out?
It's better, but not where it needs to be. So when I was starting off prosecuting computer hacking cases in the early aughts and working purely on the criminal side of the house, it was few and far between that you would get a company to cooperate. They were worried that if we go in and say we've been the victim of a hack, you're going to turn our business into a crime scene. What we're about is continuing to do business. We don't want to slow down while you do search warrants. And we don't have a lot of confidence at the end of the day, unlike other crooks, you're actually going to be able to find them and bring them to justice. So we turn our place into a crime scene for nothing. And to your point, it creates reputational damage to the brand. People won't trust us anymore. And we may get civil liability on top of that. It's a blame the victim approach. And they were scared. That started to change. So when I went over from being a prosecutor to being then director of the FBI, Bob Mueller, mm-hmm. being his chief of staff, mm-hmm. we started to look at, are there things we could do better in law enforcement to start gaining the trust and get the message out that you are the victim as a company. We're going to treat you as the victim. We're going to do what we need to do to try to keep you and others safe, but we're going to try to do it in a way that's respectful of your business. And so when it came to certain types of crime, economic espionage or trade secrets, we don't necessarily need to make the company public to get the name of the company public. And by the way, that case that we went through, Farizi, the terrorist case, that company was never named, and they were able to already prosecute
him. I was going to say, I was noticing there was the one name I wasn't getting out of you.
Exactly. And that's why we want to encourage others, if we had to use it, it's a terrorist case, it would have, may have come out at trial, but we didn't have to, and mm-hmm. we were able to have someone plead guilty and get the consequence for the crime with the company never having its name out there. Mm-hmm. One area where this was particularly important, though, so when I was on the criminal side of the house, worked with an FBI squad and great group, but there was another squad. They did the intelligence work. They were behind a locked, secure, compartmented door. And as a prosecutor, I never went on the other side of that door. Mm-hmm. Occasionally an agent would switch squads and they just disappeared, never to be seen again. When I went over to the FBI's chief of staff, the door opened. And for the first time, I saw what was happening on the intelligence side of the house. And there was outstanding work being done by the FBI at figuring out what nation states were doing inside the United States, China in particular. You were watching them hack into places like universities, jump from the university into businesses, and then watch billions of dollars of intellectual property, trade secrets, trade negotiation strategies pour out of the United States. The former head of the National Security Agency, Keith Alexander, called it the largest theft in human history.
Yeah, yeah. And so, we started with the story about an individual trying to steal, but now we're on to what governments might do. And talk about the case of China's activities and your involvement when you did see very clear cases of China, using cyber for espionage purposes economic espionage.
And the reason why we distinguish as economic espionage is this is the type, what we were seeing was information that was being stolen, not for the benefit of the state, as we would think about it, but for the benefit of the companies who were in direct competition with those who were stealing it. And they weren't stealing it themselves. They were using the military and intelligence arms of the state to get this competitive advantage. So when we saw this incredible intelligence feed of being able to watch in real time as they took this information, although it was an intelligence success, it didn't feel a lot like success.
Yeah, yeah.
So it felt like a problem that needed to be addressed. Yeah. How do we stop this from happening? And one change we thought we needed to make is at some point we got to take this out of the shadows, mm-hmm. out of the intelligence world, which still was very much modeled on a Cold War model, where when you find out about a spy, you keep it secret and maybe address it secretly or just with that nation. But that doesn't work when what you're seeing is on this scope and scale and when the victims are so much in the private sector. Because how are you going to get their attention? How are you going to help them if you keep it ultimately secret? So when I got back to run the National Security Division at the Department of Justice, we started to look, are there changes that we could make so that for today's prosecutors, we can empower them so that unlike when I was doing it, they have that door open to the intelligence side of the house. And just like we do in terrorism, we can share the information across the intelligence law enforcement divide and mm-hmm. figure out, are there creative ways we can disrupt this activity? Are there creative ways we can protect companies? And that change of approach resulted in retraining every U.S. attorney's office across the country. So in every U.S. attorney's office now, there's a specialist, a national security cyber specialist, who sees what's going on in the intelligence side and is thinking about, how do I bring a criminal case? And that mm-hmm. approach led to the first case of its kind, the indictment of five uniformed members of the People's Liberation Army, a unit called Unit 61398 that specialized in targeting businesses, U.S. businesses, for the economic gain of their competitors. And maybe talk a little bit about what we saw them taking.
What did you see them taking?
In that case, what we saw...
Because you mentioned even their notes for a court case.
Yes.
So...
Exactly. So we saw things like Westinghouse was about to do a joint venture with a Chinese partner, and they were going to lease something. They were going to lease a lead pipe, so the Chinese company would pay for it, but the secret of how to make the lead pipe would remain with Westinghouse. We saw these uniformed members of the People's Liberation Army go into their system and steal the technical design specifications for that pipe, so they no longer have to pay for it, right? They can build it themselves. Or to use another example, there was a U.S. subsidiary of a German multinational that made solar power. And there, what they stole, just from the email, was discussions about pricing. And they used that information about where they were going to price it and where they needed to price it in order to price dump, to illegally put the price below that
price. Undercut, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
And force that company into bankruptcy. And then the example that you mentioned, to add insult to injury, when that company sued for an unfair trade practice, they stole the whole litigation strategy.
Yeah.
So it gives you a sense of the scale. It was a controversial case when it happened because people said, why are you using this tool, the tool of the criminal justice system, to address state espionage? And it is an important question. And what we said was, we're doing it because it isn't traditional espionage. Spying to protect your national security is actually recognized under international law, and almost every country publicly acknowledges that they have, they don't say what they do, but that they have an agency that's doing that. What was different here is that it was theft, that it was the use of the military arm to target these private companies. We put an exhibit in this case to show just how much of this job this was. This was activity that started around 9 in the morning Beijing time, went from around 9 to noon, then they paused, looks like lunch break, for about an hour, then back to business, and you'd see it continue to the end of the day. It paused on weekends and sometimes on Chinese holidays. So
that's part of the reason you knew who was behind it.
That's right. So circumstantial evidence, right, as the prosecutor. Yeah. But also, think about it. It's the second largest military of the world, and every morning they're putting on their uniform and they're going to work, and their day job is simply to target and hack U.S. companies to steal things. I'll use another example. This wasn't through cyber hacking, actually. This was through a physical person, but to give you a sense of what they're targeting, they literally stole from DuPont a titanium dioxide formula. What's that, you may wonder? It was the formula for the color white that's used in Oreo cookies. So when we say they were stealing things that are not state secrets, but valuable, they stole the color white in the Oreo cookie.
Well, they knew an Oreo was valuable.
Yeah.
Anybody knows that. So talk a little bit about the case that seemed to be the North Korean case of attacking Sunny. And then, you know, getting emails, getting embarrassing emails, because emails always have some embarrassing emails in them. And then just getting it out over social media. That seems like... Well, do you consider that a national security case, a criminal case? How do you look at it?
So it's interesting. So the PLA case, the People's Liberation Army case that we just discussed, was the first with China. And we were wargaming out what would it look like for years. What's it going to look like if a rogue nuclear-armed nation decides to attack the United States through cyber means? And we did exercises about the electrical grid and other areas. And we all got it wrong. I mean, we never figured that the first major attack was going to be about a motion picture, right? And I don't know if you've seen that movie.
No, I haven't.
Well, we had a surreal moment in government where we all we had our very serious national security briefings in the morning, and I, the director of the FBI at the time, and the attorney general, it all had to watch this movie. It's the only time in my career I've had to go into the Situation Room, brief the national security group and the president, and start with a plot synopsis of a movie about a bunch of pot smokers, which is, if you've seen it. I blame North Korea for having to see that movie, although some people like it. So we went and did treat it like a national security event. And partly what we were thinking was, no, this wasn't what we expected. But if we don't figure out a way to respond and treat the company as a victim rather than blaming them for the fact that a foreign power was able to attack them. We're going to allow, it's not a critical physical part of our infrastructure, which is the way we had been thinking about it, but it is a core American value, the right of free speech. And the fact is that the North Korean leadership doesn't share that value, and they were reaching in from all the way across the world and attacking a company to cause fear, to prevent them, to chill them from being able to exercise free speech. And that's why we thought it was very important to treat it like a national security event that it was.
When we move on to talk a little bit about cooperation among governments, I am going to ask you about this sort of the melding of a criminal approach on the one hand and a national security issue on the other. But I wanted to just stay with this Sonny case for a moment, because in it, social media played a role, not on purpose, but it was used. It then moved to mainstream media. I was reading about the Sonny case from the New York Times. So talk a little bit about the tools that are at the disposal of the North Koreans when they want to retaliate for a movie they don't like.
Yeah, and that's a great point. So at the time, we had gotten better because we'd done this test case, which was the first time of working across law enforcement, intelligence, and cyber to make public what we were seeing in the People's Liberation Army case. And we started furiously trying to do the same here with the cooperation of Sony. Who did it? And why would they have done it? And we were able to figure out with enough confidence to say publicly that it was North Korea within 28 days, and then sanctions were imposed. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But to your question, one thing that's interesting, especially looking back on it and dissecting, what caused the harm to Sony? Why do you remember the Sony case? And when I go around the country speaking on this issue and working with clients, everyone remembers Sony. The reason why people remembered Sony was the theft of information that's not usually protected. People protect their crown jewels. They protect the infrastructure of their system. But they took just email traffic, and that was embarrassing, not trade secret, but embarrassing emails. And then they weaponized it. They took advantage of the new world that we're living in, just like the Islamic State or ISIS used social media to crowdsource terrorism. Here, North Korea used social media and these non-traditional media members to push out the embarrassing emails. They then watched as that got picked up by the mainstream media. Those are the articles that you referenced that were in every, not just tabloid, but major paper. They were on the network news. That's what caused the damage to Sony's brand. And in that sense, they took advantage of our system, our free system of expression and our free press, to cause damage to the same value. That's the reason why we have a free press, which was free speech, to punish someone for free speech. That weaponizing of information and this sideways or unusual method of attack was a lesson that we've seen other applies. It was part of the Russian toolkit or playbook when they wanted to undermine confidence, not just in our elections in 2016, but a playbook they've been doing in other elections in Europe. I think what we need to do now is realize the genie's out of the bottle.
Yeah.
And so we've seen Russia do it. The verdict is that it was successful, right? They believe that it was a success.
In the case of the U.S.
Case of the U.S. And so we should expect now, until we figure out a way to solve that problem, by either causing enough pain to the adversaries through deterrence or by hardening systems. And you can think of creative ways to do that. I'll go through one. But that others are going to copycat it. Yeah. And we need to be on the watch throughout the world. France, in terms of a low, once you start realizing the world we live in, which is why it's so important to try to make public what we're seeing bad guys do, be they nation states or crooks or terrorists, and increasingly they're blended. Once you start figuring that out and realizing the frame, and the frame is basically we moved over a 25, 30-year period from moving almost everything we value from analog space to digital space, from paper and books to bits and bytes. And we did so seeing the upside, but without calculating the risk and without thinking through, hey, now that we do this move, all the same bad guys, be they those who prey on children, terrorists, nation states, they're going to move too. And we're just starting to see now a reckoning, both in federal government and private, where people start to calculate what that risk is. Doesn't mean you drop the systems, but start thinking through, okay, if this is the world we live in, how do I protect myself? And one of the things you need to do is think through, hey, there is no product out there. I think for a while people thought, oh, if I use the right service, I can build a wall essentially that's high enough or deep enough to keep a dedicated adversary out of our system. Unfortunately, that technology does not exist. So you need to think, what's going to happen the day after? What could they do when they're inside my system? And how can I plan ahead of time based on those risks about how I can get back to doing, if it's a business, selling what I need to sell, or in the case of a campaign, how do I keep it from not causing harm to my campaign?
Macron, so it's basically a matter of resilience. It's not just prevention, but how do you bounce back?
That's the fundamental mind shift exactly from not you need to focus on prevention as well, but at just as much time, energy, and for resilience, it takes not the IT specialists, not the technical specialists, but the people in the company who really understand the core either product, if it's a business campaign strategy, or government mission, if it's a government agency. I've talked for a while to companies and said, okay, when you think about the fact the bad guy can get in your system, then don't put your crown jewels inside a folder called crown jewels. Bad idea, right? It doesn't mean you get rid of your crown jewels folder, though. Put inside there something that won't work. Let the bad guy expend time, money, energy, stealing the wrong thing, trying to use something that won't work.
We've been hearing from John Carlin on the cyber threats that he encountered when he served as Assistant Attorney General leading the National Security Division of the Justice Department. After the break, we'll consider potential strategies for strengthening cybersecurity, especially in this election year. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from John Carlin. He's one of the country's foremost experts on cybersecurity. He's the former Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's National Security Division. He's also the author of a new book entitled Dawn of the Code War. To hear this broadcast or any World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program. How can we protect against this kind of assault that's for national security purposes, but affecting individuals?
Now, it's a great question. So when I talk about where we are, we are in a place where we've moved a lot of the data into a digital world where it's vulnerable, using a protocol that was never designed with security in mind, the internet, TCP/IP protocol. And we're just trying to do catch up on the risks. But you raise a key point. It's why it's so important. I think we're talking about it today and need to get the message out is that's bad. But we're right on the cusp of a radical evolution in the way our lives work. And that is the growth of this Internet of Things, billions and billions of new connected devices. And what we can't do, what we can't afford to do, is make the same mistake again of seeing all the advantages and rushing out into that world without thinking and building in security by design. And to give some examples, this is real now, as we're on the cusp, there have been pacemakers that were literally put into people's bodies, into their hearts, where they connected them to the internet with good reason. There are advantages.
That's brilliant. But
exactly, they tested to see whether they would work. What they didn't test is to see how they would withstand an attack from someone who didn't want them to work. And what they did is they literally put them into somebody's body without encrypting it. So essentially, an 11-year-old using publicly available software could hack and kill. And if you think about, as a consumer, as individuals, we have that problem all the time with our, you know, operating system getting a little balky at home, and then you get a patch from the system, and you do the patch, and it works again. This was the same thing. They had to go patch the security vulnerability, except it's in your heart, and the consequences are life and death. We saw the same thing happen with some early adapters with drone technology, so in the skies. And then in terms of your cars on the street, we don't need to get to the self-driving car. We've already had a proof of concept hack where, with a Jeep that had already been sold to the American public, a hacker went with a reporter and showed he could get in through the entertainment system, which wasn't walled off from the braking and steering system, take over the car, which they videoed. That led to the first use of a new of an existing authority in a new way. So it led to a recall of, I think, around 2.4 million Jeeps. That, and they, what they did is they said, that's a safety defect. Just like if your brakes don't work, you need to fix it, patch it. So think about that. From the pacemakers in our hearts to the drones in the skies to the cars on our road, we are rolling out devices that are not safe. They're not building in security by design. And to your question, what can we do about it as individuals right now? Although there are certain precautions that you can and should take to try to use the internet safely, the most important thing, I think, is the demand signal that we need to change. We need to hold accountable those producing these new devices in a way that incentivizes them to build in security by design. That could be by the power of the pocketbook. It also could be by demanding change and thinking of new ideas. Ideas that have been floated in this area include labeling, some process so that a third party certifies this company has followed basic security by design principles, or it could ratchet up in certain industries so that they're highly regulated, get audited.
Yeah, but this is an era of kind of getting rid of regulations. Does that concern you? Is this a time when we ought to be revisiting regulations and taking them much more seriously?
I think everything should be on the table as we try to figure out how to make sure. And it's ultimately long-term, it's better for commerce. What we don't want to do is essentially build out a house of straw and then wait as the big bad wolves, whether they're nation-state hackers, the really sophisticated, well-funded, organized criminal groups and terrorists who increasingly are converging. And we could talk about this a little bit on the so-called dark web and in dark marketplaces. We don't want to wait till that wolf is at the door blowing our house down. That's bad ultimately for commerce. And I will say, I do think this is starting to penetrate into the C-suites of the companies thinking and planning in this area. But government should be doing more. At a minimum, government should be doing more in terms of educating and helping to bring together these sectors in a way they can share lessons. I mean, it's really an ecosystem, right? You can't protect the financial system unless you also protect the electrical grid on which it relies, and you also protect the information technology sector on which it relies. These little vulnerabilities, let's say, I used more dramatic examples that are real, but let's talk about the little stuff in your house. The problem is, if you roll out vulnerable devices like webcams and other little household products, and they're not encrypted, so it's easy to hack. What the hackers, and this isn't a hypothetical, they've done it, they can hack into all of those devices and they build what's called a botnet. They build essentially an army of compromised machines, a cyber weapon of mass destruction. And then with a single command, they can turn all of that bandwidth and blast the outward-facing websites. This happened, and the so-called Mirai botnet, and it actually took down part of the internet for a period of time. So there was no connectivity, disrupting everyone's line of business. So
this, when was this?
This was about 2 years ago. In 2016, fall of 2016, I believe. And they, we'd seen botnets before, but they'd used more traditional computers. One of the case we'd brought against Iranian, members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, or groups associated with them, had used botnets, that same technique, to attack almost every part of our financial sector. And what they did, just like the North Koreans figured out this softer spot to attack, they didn't hit the most protected part of the financial system infrastructure. Instead, they hit the outward-facing websites, but now so many consumers rely on them for online banking, right? And so they hit over 47 different financial institutions, affecting hundreds of thousands of customers and costing tens of millions of dollars with a botnet. And that was a botnet that's relatively small compared to what you could do once you start having your, you know, everything from your refrigerator to your toaster to your video camera online. Now, in that case, similarly, I don't think in the beginning we did as good a job as we could at talking to the financial sector and letting them know what we knew in government. We still were of that classified mindset. And as it continued and we matured in this new approach of treating them as a victim, I think we got better at sharing information and determined to do what we ultimately did, which is take it public, give the detail, and say by name who did it. Because although they think they're anonymous overseas, we're actually can be pretty good at attribution as long as we don't keep it secret. And one thing that was helpful in that case as well is once you dove in deeply as to what these groups were doing, they weren't just doing this botnet against the financial sector. They were inside, and actually it was relatively small dam, but they were inside the critical infrastructure. They had hacked inside this small dam in Rye, New York, called the Bowman Dam.
We should probably stop and just say a second and describe what critical infrastructure is, because I think of that as, you know, our energy systems, our transportation, our communication. What comprises critical infrastructure, and in whose hands do the switches sit?
And then
go to the Rye, New York Dam.
So 2 points on that. There's a broad definition that's defined by statute and regulation of what's currently in critical infrastructure, and it crosses about 16 different areas. It includes things like water supply, electrical grid, rail, financial sector, nuclear.
In whose hands is that government controlled, or is this, you know, are these all controlled and owned by private sector institutions?
That's what makes it so different than the vast majority of critical infrastructure stuff our nation relies on is in private hands, and it's why for this problem to be solved we need to come up with a new way of partnering the public and private sector. So it's a great point.
And in the case in Rye, New York, what happened?
In the case in Rye, New York, these Iranian hackers had accessed the sluice control systems, the controls that allow you to open and shut the dam. Now, two things. One, actually, the dam was down. It wasn't working for physical reasons at the time. But I think you'll agree our crumbling infrastructure should not be our first line of defense against cyber actors. The other thing that's kind of interesting is it's a relatively small dam. It's not something you consider a key part of the infrastructure. And there are a lot of different theories, including that they may have accidentally hit the wrong dam. There's another Bowman Dam that's bigger, that's in a different part of the country and located overseas. We don't know. But that allowed at least to make clear that it wasn't the stuff of science fiction, that sophisticated nation-state actors can enter our physical infrastructure and cause harm. And that's why it's so urgent that we take steps to address it now. What we don't want to see happen is we start taking these steps, whether they're necessary regulations, whether they're voluntary steps, that we don't wait until after we've had a September 11th type incident in this space before people take action. And boy, we've had some really public, devastating events already, but I'm not sure yet. It's starting to change minds, but it's caused the urgency in this change in action that we need. We're at war. It's a code war, and we're just at the dawn of this code war, but it's here.
Mm-hmm. We also go on the offense. Sometimes there's cyber command here in as part of our military operation. It's not just using the intelligence you use to figure out what's coming. It's also taking action at times to disrupt that effort. They can see a threat coming. They try to disable whatever that is. Talk about their role. Talk about the role of the military in all of this.
Yeah, and so to follow up on your point, in terms of defense alone, there's layered defense, including what's known sometimes as active defense. Mm-hmm. And this is the idea that there's only so much you can do when the payload, the malware, or the call for lots of activity through the botnet is hitting the system. You can try to take defensive measures. You need to focus on resilience. But active defense would mean, is there a way to shut that off from where it's coming? And that often is taking place overseas. Make cyber more difficult than some areas is that might involve going directly if you can locate it to the nation state. But cyber attacks often occur through multiple countries. Mm-hmm. So that might mean, can we take action? And what type of action can we take if we have to go through a friendly country? Yeah. Do we need their permission? Can we do it without their permission if it's exigent circumstances? The other issue that's quite complicated in this area goes to the blended threat. We talked a little bit about, for instance, the botnet. What we're seeing is there's an incredibly sophisticated dark market that looks like ordinary commerce. So if you go on today and you know that where to go on that portion of the web that is not indexed, so it doesn't show up in your Google search, but you know exactly where to work in the so-called dark web.
Yeah.
You'll see sites that look just like Amazon. And when I say they look like Amazon, I mean literally, you go on, it's crooks. They're saying things like, we've stolen credit cards, and we'll sell you the stolen credit cards for $1,000. And it'll have customer reviews with the 5-star system. And so you'll see a review that says, 5 stars. I've bought from this crook before. Very reliable, high rate of return on the stolen credit cards. And then you'll see another review that says, 1 star. This always makes me laugh, but they'll be outraged. This crook can't be trusted. They sold me stuff that isn't working. One of these sites was called In Fraud, and its motto, and this was really the motto on the site when you went on it, was In Fraud We Trust.
Oh, my God.
And that's where the crooks were gathering. I raised that.
So this is cooperation amongst criminal groups.
Exactly.
Well, we're worried about cooperation with governments. Okay. Take us further.
They're sophisticated. And to your question and how and when to use the military, one of the complicating factors will be, to use that same example, one of the things they might be selling there will be a botnet for rent.
Yeah.
So one criminal group just goes out and creates the cyber weapon of mass destruction. They collect these hundreds of thousands of compromised computers, and they rent them for criminal purposes. So the botnet might be used to use one like Game Over Zeus for something called ransomware attacks, where they use the fact that they have this capability to get inside your computer, to lock up everything on your computer, to encrypt it, and then demand payment if you want to see your data again. So just a way to make a buck. But there's one criminal group that specializes in the botnet and another criminal group who rents it out because they specialize in doing the ransomware attack. Or to use another example with the same one, they took naked pictures using a webcam of a teen beauty queen and then threaten to embarrass her by releasing the information. Same way, make a buck.
Yeah.
However, it's for rent again. So a nation state or a terrorist group could potentially get on the dark web, rent the tool that's created by a criminal group, and use it momentarily for a nation state purpose. Who do you hit when that happens, and how do you figure out who's behind the veil that's the nation state rather than the criminal group? This blend of criminals and intelligence is a huge current problem, and in part, I think it's a Russia problem. So we think about the criminal world as being, you know, too diffuse. We can't figure out who did it. And there aren't good studies on this right now, according to CSIS estimate, and they're going to do a more rigorous study.
CSIS.
It's a non-profit center think tank inside of Washington, D.C. And there are others who need to study this question. But they estimate, they think around 40% of internet crime in the world is coming from Russia. So in large respects, our criminal problem is a Russia problem. One case, there was a massive hack that many folks know of, Yahoo.
Yes.
Stole all sorts of email information. The person behind it was a crook, and actually was one of the top 10 most wanted criminals for the FBI. The FBI issued a request, and this is public in the charging document, that said to their Russian counterparts, hey, let's cooperate when it comes to crime. This isn't nation-state activity. Can you help us arrest and bring to justice this thief who steals mainly credit card numbers? And the Russians said, thank you for the information, and then signed him up as an intelligence asset. So he would keep doing his criminal activity, but they would also benefit and use him for intelligence purposes. This is all laid out in the indictment. So when you have that hybrid type of threat, I think it is important that we continue to develop the capacity of the Department of Defense. But ultimately, for this type of problem, it's going to have to involve all the tools of government power that you can bring at disposal, from criminal to civil and regulatory to diplomatic. And ultimately, you need a meeting of minds of countries around the world that say, I don't want to live in the Wild West when it comes to cyber. We want to live in a rule of law. Let's agree on norms. And for those few countries who are rogue, who will not agree to or live by those norms, let's collectively figure out ways to deter them and increase the cost of doing business this way until they stop.
Yeah. As we turn to this notion of norms, we have a problem, and that is that we use cyber weapons ourselves. I mean, in the case of that we were just talking about to prevent an impending attack. But I mean, I'm not asking you to confirm or deny something, but it's widely believed that we were responsible for various missile tests going awry in North Korea, you know, missiles sort of blowing up on launch pad. It's also widely believed that the U.S. played a role in trying to disrupt the Iranian nuclear program by sending centrifuges spinning. Do we have the? I mean, it's a valuable tool, right? And sometimes for very legitimate reasons, you'd want to pursue it. It's kind of security short of war or something like that. When you have that kind of need as a state, and you have that kind of advantage, I mean, we were kind of way out front on cybersecurity at a time. Are you willing to be forward-leaning about a kind of arms control approach of getting together with other countries and saying, look, there's certain things that are just not acceptable and other things that are, and we're going to voluntarily, you know, join together on that. How are we doing when it comes to setting of norms and entering into agreements?
Yeah, it's such an important... So I think we both, in some respects, have the greatest capability but also the greatest vulnerabilities, yeah, because we move the fastest to digitalize and we're often on the cutting edge of adding new products, new services, the Internet of Things, bringing it to new areas on our vulnerability. So I think it's vital that we are, as we have been ever since World War II, are at the center of a rules-based regime that includes creating norms. I'll give you one example. And in this space, it sometimes can be hard, I think, to negotiate out these norms in some big multilateral treaty. Takes forever, lots mm-hmm. of disputes, versus starting to live by and make public the norms by you're living by and enforcing mm-hmm. them. So to use an example, going back to that People's Liberation Army case, there's a concept in U.S. Law that derives from European common law that says if you let someone walk across your lawn long enough, they get what's called an easement, which is the legal right to walk across your lawn. One of the reasons we brought the criminal case and made it public was just like you put up a no trespass sign on your lawn to show you don't approve, we were allowing such large theft so noisily from China, we were starting to set for international law, which is a rule of customary law. Mm-hmm. So it looks mm-hmm. at the way people are actually acting, and that often becomes then enshrined in international law. We were setting the norm that says it's okay to use your military and intelligence target private companies for the benefit of their competitors. So in some ways, it was a giant no trespass sign, get off our lawn. And one promising development that came out of that was a bilateral negotiation. It was post, going back to the North Korean attack on Sony. As we sat around the Situation Room and tried to think of what our responses could be, just like we do for terrorist or other actions, we realized, boy, when it comes to cyber, we don't have the same range. We don't have the same range of tools. We don't have the same toolkit that we do. For instance, we don't have an executive order that gives the authority to sanction not just those who commit the theft, but also those who benefit from the commission mm-hmm. of the theft. Mm-hmm. We don't have that authority the way we do for terrorists and did for those who would proliferate weapons of mass destruction. So later that next year, in April, the president signed in for the first time an executive order that said, when it comes to cyber activity, including for economic espionage, we can levy sanctions. Now, with North Korea and Sony, North Korea had done so many other bad things yep. that you could sanction them, and they're a notoriously difficult state actor. But having that regime, I think, helped with other countries. We had a breakthrough with China that was a combination, I think, of the bringing criminal charges, which surprised them, and having this new authority to sanction that they thought we were going to use. They sent, right before a summit where President Xi and President Obama were going to meet, they sent over suddenly a huge contingent, along with a personal emissary from President Xi, to negotiate with us. And we had mm-hmm. these round-the-clock negotiations prior to the summit to hammer out, exactly to your point, what are some norms that both countries can live by? And one of them was, you shouldn't use your military and intelligence to target a private company for the benefit of its economic competitor. And President Xi, for the first time, said publicly, I agree with that norm. President Obama said, I agree with that norm. That breakthrough allowed the G20 then to adopt that same norm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we did see a decrease of exactly that type of activity. Now, if that sounds a little bit narrow, that's because it is.
Yeah,
and so we are seeing Chinese activity targeting other institutions and still targeting private companies, but it looks like activity that would be consistent with what they would consider a state need rather than private to private. So there's lots of work to be done in developing these norms, but there are some norms now that are starting to be adopted. One area you see from that approach, partly what helped is doing retribution, doing deterrence, and enforcing the norm. That's where we could do more work. This year, I think there was important work that this administration did by making public a couple of different incidents, and I'll walk through them a little bit. One was a so-called ransom worm. This is called WannaCry. Now, this is a piece of code that, it like ransomware, goes into your computer, locks it up, and says, give me money if you want to see your data again. But this one self-propagates. So instead of a hacker having to get in and break into your system, this one just starts moving from system to system to system.
Yeah.
And so we had our first global outbreak of a ransom worm with an attack called WannaCry. And you raised earlier the point about hospitals. It hit hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was indiscriminate. also, you didn't get your money. You didn't get anything back if you paid. So it looks like maybe a tool of the state gone wrong. I thought it was great that ultimately, somewhat belatedly, but ultimately the U.S. government said that's North Korea that did WannaCry. And then we saw Russia do something similar where they unleashed a similar type of tool. People call it not Petya because there was a different version called Petya. This one's similar, but not Petya. Mm-hmm. So it got that name. Who can make these things up with the the computer science crowd? But so not Petya. It targeted Ukraine, looked like for political purposes, and then hit companies like FedEx. FedEx has said it cost them around $300 million. Maersk. It caused, again, a global outbreak. And it was good. The UK did it first, and then the US followed suit. The people said that's Russia, and ultimately they issued sanctions. I worry, though, we're not, if it's that type of rogue activity, and that is a norm, there's no country in the world that thinks it's okay to indiscriminately unleash a tool.
Yeah.
Once you've assigned who did it, they won't acknowledge that it occurred, and they're not paying the price that they caused others to endure. I think we need to ratchet up the use of sanctions, and it needs to be done multilaterally. It needs countries around the world who are affected need to get together and say, this is not okay.
Yeah, yeah. Let's turn, because you've said that it may be that the vast majority of the attacks, even the thefts and the extortion, have Russia behind them. I'm struck by the fact that various, the House Intelligence Committee, for example, looking at the role Russia played, they seem to be treating it as a domestic partisan issue as opposed to a national security issue. What is the impact of kind of getting it wrong in that sense, not seeing it in its national security light?
Yeah, so I hope so much, and I think this is an area where ultimately we can, that we come together as a country and recognize this for what it is, which is there is an adversary overseas who fundamentally does not share our value of what it is to be American. And Putin's Russia, they fear democracy, not a party, not Democratic or Republican, democracy as an existential threat to his regime. And he thinks he's at war, and that if he doesn't prevail over democracy as a way of life, that his regime will fail. We need to recognize that's the world in which we're living, and that's what's driving his actions, be they physical or in the cyber world, and come together and say that unites us as Americans. We may have our disagreements over policy, but fundamentally we believe in our democratic system. And with being unified across party on that, there are steps that we can take now, both defensively to harden our systems and focus on what it takes to protect us from that type of attack, and also to deliver the clear message back, not just to Russia, but other countries around the world, that this is not acceptable behavior and there will be consequences.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured our conversation with John Carlin. He's one of the country's foremost experts on cybersecurity. He's the former Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's National Security Division. He's also the author of a new book entitled Dawn of the Cold War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.